You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled, and marginalized creatives and their art. You can now support the show by becoming a patron on Patreon. For as little as £1 a month, you can get early access to shows, exclusive content, and a shout out to say thank you. To find out more, visit patreon.com/agparker. And now, on with the show. So today on the podcast, we've got JP Seabright, who is a queer writer living in London. They have three pamphlets published, Fragments from Before the Fall, an anthology of post-Anthropocene poetry, the erotic memoir No Holds Barred, and Genderfucks, a collaborative poetry pamphlet. Machinations, another collaborative work, is out later this year, as is Because, a poetry microchap. JP is assistant editor of Full House Literary Magazine and was nominated for a Pushcart Prize in October 2021. JP, welcome to the Cabinet of Curiosities. How are you?
I'm good. And thank you, George. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for inviting me to come along.
Oh my God, it's an absolute honour. So I want to start by saying congratulations on your latest pamphlet, Genderfucks. It's an absolute belter of a book.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm really proud of that one. It was an interesting journey. And I feel for me, I think the whole process of doing that kind of collaboration with Jem and Jonathan, and then, you know, getting it accepted, and then having it published earlier this year, and then finally being able to do a live launch is fantastic. It's the first time for me that I was able to do any of those things, so, you know, it means a great deal to me, aside from the subject matter, which of course I guess we'll go on to talk about.
Yeah, which is absolutely fantastic. So for anyone who doesn't know, it's a collaborative pamphlet which you wrote with two other poets, Jem Henderson and Jonathan Kinsman. What was it like putting that together and launching it in the midst of a pandemic, you know, particularly when it's the time when so many people were feeling isolated, and when even at the best of times writing in itself can be quite a solitary act, to have that connection, what was that like?
Well, I mean, it was great but also slightly weird. So, and I can't actually compare it with anything else, because I've only done one other collaboration since, which, you know, we can perhaps talk about later. That's Machinations, which is out later. So this was the first time I'd ever done any kind of collaborative creative work with anyone, and it came about on Twitter, essentially. So I have to say, sort of, Twitter has been a real lifeline for me, kind of, not just during the pandemic, but I think in general, because pandemic or not, I think when you've got ME, so I've got ME, chronic fatigue, and I've had that for, gosh, 25 years, something like that, I lose track now. Mm. You know, perhaps those sort of poetry groups, or even book groups, or kind of going to workshops, or kind of going to readings or events, are things that are kind of very difficult for me to do anyway. So I think the positive thing, and it's an awful thing to say, but I guess a kind of benefit in a way of everybody moving online during the pandemic meant that a lot of these things were kind of available to me for the first time.
And I
guess perhaps you found that too, or perhaps some of your other guests have mentioned that. So it came about through Twitter, and I sort of knew of Jem simply because we both had a piece published in I think it was the second Full House journal, that must have been maybe in March 2021. And I think because of that, I kind of connected on Twitter to most of the other people that were also published in that same journal. This was before I went on to volunteer on the editorial team for Full House, and then you know, later Leia asked me to sort of be kind of assistant editor to support her. So we only knew of each other through that, and then we saw this call out from Nine Pens Press, who are the publisher, looking for collaborations, and their idea was just to simply put three poets together, nine poems each, and then kind of package that up into a sort of mini anthology. Mm. And they didn't have to be poets that knew each other or that kind of were working on a collaborative project, but we kind of liked the idea of doing that. And Jem knew Jonathan already before, and we just sort of got together initially over Twitter, and then we had a few sort of Zoom calls to talk about it, and that was it really. So we then spent I think it was only about 4 or 5 weeks in total working on this pamphlet, working on Genderfucks. And I think maybe Jonathan and maybe Jem both had a poem that they had either had previously published or at least was already completed. But other than that, we decided to do everything from scratch. So we kind of shared a lot of stuff that we had that we felt was perhaps on similar themes. The theme kind of suggested itself, I guess, because we're all queer and or trans poets. So we felt it was quite exciting to kind of just focus on that as a topic, particularly from a sort of trans masculine point of view, because that's a viewpoint that's perhaps you don't hear so much about, or that voice, those voices are not always so readily heard. So we kind of explored that, I suppose, from our own lived experience, sort of sexuality, identity, gender, of course. And yeah, that's sort of, it was Genesis. And you know, as I said, it was done quite quickly and it was done over a fairly few sessions, and we thought that was fun, let's send it off, see what happens. And we got a acceptance from Colin, the publisher, before the closing date, so within about 48 hours of us sending it off, which was really
And I have to say, reading it, you wouldn't immediately get the impression that it's three people who haven't spent, you know, like a year working together on a project with a very specific thing in mind. It feels so cohesive. It's amazing you put it together in 5 weeks, having not really known each other and not really knowing what you were kind of doing before entering into it.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I'm glad that people get that impression. I mean, I think we've all got sort of different voices, and I think for me at least, you know, I have far less experience in writing poetry than either of those two, so for me it was very formative experience, and I think I learned a lot, probably things that I would do differently now, but I think that's always part of your creative process, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting and what was different from the other I think three other sort of anthologies that came out of this series, and is that we were the only ones to do this, is we decided not to sort of split it into kind of three distinct sections, you know, so like my poems, Jem's poems, Jonathan's poems, whatever. We kind of really responded to each other's work, and then we looked at the order and we decided how to structure the whole thing based on, I suppose, the sort of journey we wanted to take people through, if you like. And we only put at the end, in the sort of acknowledgements, who had written which poem. And I really like that. I'm really glad that we made that choice. And it wasn't that much of a self-conscious decision. It just felt the natural thing to do at the time,
and it absolutely works, as you say. It kind of, it takes you on that flow, you take the reader on a journey, and actually not interrogating who's written which piece, is it gives this lovely whole feeling to it.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed. I mean, we only met each other, the three of us, actually in the same physical space as each other when we did the live launch in May this year, you know. I mean, I think John and Jennifer, Jem, had met each other in person, because they, you know, both lived sort of around sort of Leeds area. Jonathan's now in York, but the three of us together had never met, so that was cool. I mean, I hope we get to do it again sometime, because it was such a, you know, such a joyful moment of actually being able to read these out loud and sort of come to that full circle of having done it remotely, quickly over Zoom, and now feel like now we're kind of reading these to a whole load of bunch of people in a room. So that was great.
And it was a wonderful launch. It was absolutely, like, the vibe was incredible. All the poets that you had read was wonderful. And I remember sitting there watching you perform and genuinely having tears in my eyes, because of that feeling of, like, you know, oh, it's not just me, or I get that. And that in itself is profoundly healing and affirmative, especially for those of us who grew up with, you know, Section 28, who maybe never got that much in the way of validation or acceptance of our identities when we were younger. It feels like society is finally emerging into its fullness, and so many people are starting to accept who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite a lot older than both Jem and Jonathan. And I think it was also interesting that we were coming with different sort of experiences of coming out. And I think that's sort of clear in some of the themes or some of the poems that we wrote. And I mean, they're all obviously equally valid and different challenges now that people might have coming out than they might have done 20 years or so ago, and obviously much, much longer ago. But yeah, it is so great to be able to kind of talk about that and share it in a room of like-minded people who get it, you know. And I guess, you know, in some ways that's one of the beautiful things about poetry, is it can convey that emotion so much more immediately perhaps than prose can, and especially when you have the opportunity to kind of voice it out loud and see people's response. You know, that was only the second time I've ever performed anything kind of to a room of people, you know, as well. So that was a great experience too.
I was going to say, it sounds like you've had this real kind of opening up in terms of your career in the last, you know, year or two, which is, it's amazing. But what I really can't get over is, as a fellow disabled artist, I know what it's like to form a connection with people kind of on the internet, because that's what you have. Oftentimes that's the only time you have access to society is online. And so to go from kind of being on Twitter to meeting people via Zoom, to writing a poetry collection with them, and then to having that book launch, it's just such a wonderful journey. And I think it really shows the power of community online, and then also the power of poetry as well. It's fantastic.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. So I don't have anything to add to that, because I think you summarized that so beautifully, so perfectly. Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just, you know, I've got like, you know, certain notes written down, and then I just had this moment of just being struck by the absolute wonder that is that process that you described. So it's just amazing. What's the importance to you of sharing these stories and creating these pieces which connect the queer community in particular?
Well, I have to be honest here, is I always feel like a little bit of a reluctant poet, or at least I don't really feel that it's a label that quite suits me. I don't feel that I'm good enough, if you see what I mean. And I don't really know much about the craft, you know, and I haven't kind of had a creative writing degree, and I haven't gone to many workshops because of the challenges that I mentioned, you know, aside from my sort of disability and that kind of chronic illness, because that creates additional constraints in terms of work and finances and this sort of thing, you know. It's even though I'm not a working class writer, I can't make any claims to that. You know, my parents were teachers, that firmly makes me middle class. There is an assumption that people who perhaps, you know, that means that you have disposable income, that you're wealthy. Yeah. But you know, I'm sure you might also recognize that having a long-term disability, particularly if you're not you know, and I guess I'd be fortunate that hasn't at times it's certainly been bad enough for me to not be able to work or leave the house, or been sort of you know, bedbound and housebound for long periods of time. But most of the time I've been able to function to some extent, and that's meant that I'm not eligible for benefits. So then you have that sort of double-edged sword of kind of needing to work in order to kind of pay the rent, but not being really well enough to do that or anything else in addition to that. So sorry, I'm kind of moving away from your question, but I think being able to, I think I'm answering a different question.
Please, no, go on. Tell us how the system is
broken. I think what I found really sort of powerful or significant for me in the last, I guess, 18 months, is feeling that I could write about the things that were very personal to me. And that's what I mean. I don't feel like I'm really a poet in that sense, is that most of the stuff that I write tends to be from my own personal experience. Not everything, but that's, I guess, where the impetus comes from. And there are sort of similar themes, you know, around that. And queerness is definitely one of them. You know, I guess, I think also kind of trauma to some extent, and how that impacts the body as much as the mind, you know, on a long-term basis.
We love talking about that on this podcast.
Okay, great. Well, we can always come back to that. So I think feeling that it was okay to write about those things, and that there was an audience, I suppose, for them, was very empowering, because otherwise it just been something that I'd write sort of secretly in my notebook and just think, oh, that's just too much like confessional poetry. Nobody's interested in that. You know what I mean? And I think there's still a lot of elitism, if that's the right word, or you know, kind of
gatekeeping.
You know, yeah, around, you know, what is the proper subject, or you know, this is stuff that's just kind of airing your dirty laundry in public, you know. But my feeling is that if it's experience that you've gone through, it is inevitable that someone else will have gone through something quite similar. And I think that's what I meant earlier about poetry has a really powerful way of connecting people's emotions through that, because it is often so immediate, and it kind of conjures up images and emotions and you know, memories and that sort of thing. You know, and I think that helped me feel valid, or, you know, justified, I suppose, in writing about the things that I felt I wanted to write about or were important. And I guess I hadn't seen previously myself, you know. So I think another advantage of so many things moving online in the last sort of 2 years is that we have seen a lot new journals, particularly sort of poetry magazines, and some of them are just operating online. And some of them have disappeared, of course, because it's difficult to sustain them. But I think it has given a lot more space to new voices, and people are able to kind of tackle themes and perhaps be more experimental, and to play around with form quite a lot, and be published in these sorts of places where perhaps before the kind of more traditional poetry magazines, you know, you needed, you know, you know, it was quite difficult to kind of get those sort of themes or that kind of more kind of unconstructed forms to be accepted.
Yeah. And I love how much people are willing to experiment beyond kind of the bounds of the traditional now in terms of poetry. And also, as you say, what we consider to be an acceptable form of poetry, I think, is changing. We're starting to see a completely different landscape in terms of style, genre, subject matter as well. And I think that can only be a good thing, that it's opening up. But there's also just such an abundance of real, joyful, excellent poetry. And I think quantity, sometimes the more people produce, the more likely you are to get something that is absolutely fantastic.
I feel like I'm influenced in some way by almost everything that I read, even if that influence is a kind of reaction against it, you know, or a kind of negative one. You kind of think, oh yeah, I didn't like that, and then it's like, well, why didn't I like that, you know? Or you read something and then it kind of triggers an idea or something, perhaps months and months in the future. So I guess, you know, it's good, just good that we've got that level of variety now, which is great. I mean, having the time to read it is another matter, of course. But, you know.
As you say, it all goes on the compost heap, which is fantastic. And then, you know, at some point we produce something out of that glorious pile of whatever we've kind of filtered into our minds. So obviously, the more people feel able to be able to discuss various different things in art, which is wonderful, the more, I suppose, each of us feels empowered to then explore our own trauma or our own identities. So you came out in 1994 and you were diagnosed with ME in 1996. And you say here that the two are not related. I completely believe you. Yeah.
As far as I know. Yeah.
And you say that you've largely hidden the latter part from family and close friends, but tell everyone immediately about the former. My friend Andrew says that to be disabled and queer, you have to come out twice. And I think with invisible disabilities like ME, we often have to come out time and time again, sometimes on a daily basis. Why do you think hiding our disabilities is what so many of us do, yourself included, when it comes to something like sexuality or gender, where we're often a lot more outspoken?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And I don't know if I can speak for anyone other than me, but if I explain that, and I'm probably explaining it more to myself out loud, you know, it may be that it's true for many other people. When I came out, so yes, it was in 1994, because that's the title of the poem, which I just sort of describe this in Genderfucks. I was 21 in 1994. 1994. And I wasn't an immediate kind of process. I mean, it was something I was aware of for some time before that, of course. But I guess it took a while to accept it for myself. Mm. Made slightly somewhat more complicated that I was quite heavily involved in an evangelical cult whilst I was at university. So that made coming out a little bit more of a challenge, which maybe we need to talk about in a whole different podcast another time. But you know, you've read Genderfuck, so you know, you'll know that there's also some references to that in one of my poems. So and then it took me a while to kind of come out to family, friends at university, that was very easy. And I was very sort of fortunate, I think, in that respect. I think in terms, and you know, now, I mean, you know, I'm out at work, I'm out with everyone I meet, and I always make a point of doing that quite quickly. And I guess it's because I just, I'm very happy, you know, in you know, and confident, I suppose, in my sexuality, in my kind of identity, queer identity, and don't want to hide that. You know, I've kind of seen what it does to other people, and you know, I'm choosing deliberately not to put myself in that situation, even if it means that I'm going to have to sort of face discrimination or challenges and things.
Yeah.
I know that I've been relatively lucky in that I live in a country in which it's not illegal. So obviously for many people, they have huge, huge kind of constraints to deal with. That said, I've also made the choice to mainly work in the public sector in the UK and in not-profit, where it's perhaps been easier, or that I've worked for organisations in which that's been quite a sort of, you know, it's not been difficult to be out, and there's always been other out people as well. So, and I kind of taken the view that, you know, if they have a problem with that, then I don't want to work for them. But I appreciate that that's a very fortunate position to be in, if you like. In terms of kind of coming out, in terms of my illness, I mean, I think that's partly because it took me a long time to accept it for myself. And this is perhaps the nature of a disability like ME, in that, you know, it was often a sort of kind of diagnosis because they didn't know what else it might be. And it was sort of, rather than it being a positive diagnosis, it was like, well, we've tested everything else, we've got no idea what it is, so we think it's probably this. And I guess, you know, I started having the symptoms for it whilst I was still at university, and diagnosed in 96, which is when I graduated, at a time where there'd recently been a lot of stuff in the papers sort of at the end of the 80s and the early 90s around yuppie flu.
That's in my notes, it's here.
Oh really? Okay. You know, where it was suddenly becoming more, people are becoming more aware of it, but it was very maligned and people didn't understand it, and it was sort of, people were dismissive of it. So I think because there was not only just a huge lack of understanding, and that was, you know, let alone the society, but in the medical profession itself, plus it was something that was kind of sneered at and dismissed and sort of belittled. And there was all this kind of like, oh, you're just tired all the time. It's like, no, it's a whole lot more complicated than that. And even now, unfortunately, you know, there is still that view, I think, amongst a lot of people as to trying to understand what it is. So I think, to be honest, that probably had the biggest influence on me feeling, finding it difficult to talk about to other people because it would be dismissed or not understood. Plus, I suppose I was wishing it away and wanting to kind of get on with my life and find a way to manage it, or hoping that there might be other tests and things I could do, or hoping there might be a cure, if you like, because again, this was sort of fairly early days of the health sector trying to understand what the, you know, what the treatment might be. You know, I was sent off to do GET programs and biofeedback. I saw Dr. White, and you know, all of those, and which was seen as being the best treatment you could get at the time.
Yeah.
But obviously, all the kind of stuff that has now been finally properly discredited as actually making patients a lot worse. I don't know if you want me to go into more details on that and the benefits of listeners, but
absolutely. Graded exercise therapy, so it's now been shown to be detrimental to health, as it can push someone into an extreme fatigue flare, immune dysfunction, and those with moderate symptoms can experience a severe escalation of symptoms, leaving them permanently worse. I mean, I think I've even heard of someone, you know, going into a coma because of it. But, you know, kind of the extremities aside, GET has been proven time and time again to be really dangerous. And even, I want to say it was even like 6 weeks ago, And I said, you know, I'm having a really bad ME flare. And I went to my GP and they said, have you tried GET? And I said, it's been taken off the NICE guidelines. Everything has been changed. But the fact that GPs still haven't quite caught up with that, and the medical professionals as a whole, yes, they do understand a little bit more about ME, but it's still very much kind of looked down upon as, I think there's still a bit of a hangover of that yuppie flu rhetoric.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think, you know, in some ways I feel like, you know, maybe if I'd been a bit more bold about it and talking to people about it and kind of trying to educate them, if you like, then I wouldn't have hidden it so much. But I think it was difficult when you just didn't have the answers yourself, you know, because the medical profession didn't have the answers. So, you know, I did spend a lot of time, and I think this is when I had, usually when I had sort of significant crashes, kind of, you know, either completely immersing myself in it and trying every possible treatment out there, you know, those that might be mildly helpful to those that were kind of complete crackpot kind of stuff, because I desperately wanted to get well. And it was also a sense of like, what is this strange kind of thing? You know, and then periods of just trying to think, well, I manage it to the extent that I can, and I want to get on with my life. So, you know, even now, it's not something that is really talked about within my own family. You know, my parents know, of course, and they get it, but they don't know what to do. And I think that's partly them also sort of feeling a bit powerless as to how to help. Kind of close friends know, of course, but and some are more sympathetic than others. And I don't blame them for that, but because they're more influenced by the perception that it has in, you know, society as a whole. You know, and it's quite difficult to get the balance right. And I'm sure I could be better in this, in wanting to be able to talk about it just in a very open, kind of almost neutral way, just matter of fact. I mean, I think this is something that you're really, really good at. And just the fact that you have this podcast where it's a subject where, you know, it's openly discussed is brilliant. So being able to talk about it in that way without it feeling as though you're burdening people and you're just listing a whole load of symptoms about how shit you feel, you know. So I guess I'm still working on getting that balance right, you know.
I think sometimes though that's in how people receive it. And I you know, I've witnessed it where somebody who's got a disability or a chronic health condition is just talking very much, you know, someone says, how are you? Do you want to go and do this? And the person will say, I'd love to go and do that, but actually at the moment I've got, you know, like a dislocated kneecap or something. And the person who isn't disabled is listening to this, and you can see their face being like, oh, for fuck's sake, like why are they telling me about these miserable details of their disability? And it's like, actually I almost feel like people expect disabled people to moan, and a lot of this is because of the representation that we have as, you know, being quite like depressed about what our bodies are doing. And as you say, so many people are just very matter of fact about it, very much kind of get on and go about their daily business listening to their body and what it needs. But I think a lot of people do expect us to behave a certain way, and so they react to their expectation.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I suppose it's you know, it is a journey, you know. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that you sort of make that comparison between sort of coming out as disabled and coming out as queer, because I think in some ways it's not a dissimilar process of kind of accepting it yourself and then sort of telling people, and you might tell some people more than others, and then it's sort of living it, and it's in the way in which you live it and sort of kind of demonstrate it, if you like, you know, to society. You know, and yeah, maybe it's weird that I feel completely comfortable in doing that in terms of my sexuality, but still find it very difficult, you know, especially at this age, you know, it's still a challenge. You know, with the health, but it's partly the nature of the disease in that it's so unpredictable.
Yeah,
it's so completely unpredictable. So, you know, I think if you knew, okay, I'm just going to crash now for 3 months, then you could sort of plan for it and you could tell people. And then if you knew I'm going to be able to do sort of a few, you know, mildly normal activities, then again, people can adjust and know what to expect from you.
Yeah.
doesn't work like that, it's, as you know.
It's the dynamic nature of it. You're absolutely right. And as we were saying just before we started recording as well, you can feel fine or you can push yourself to do an activity, and then 2 days later, you get hit that post-exertional malaise and you're in bed for, you know, it can be like, as you say, months at a time, just a horrendous flare.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe I can mention something. It's, that sounds like a little bit of a plug, but it's interesting that I just got an email about it just before we started talking. A few months ago, actually, I was approached by another writer, Katie Wimhurst, who I've also sort of got to know on Twitter and also has ME. And she has put together a few of us to write a short piece about how it affects our writing.
Oh, amazing.
For me, that was really kind of quite cathartic because I hadn't really thought about it before, mainly because I tend to kind of pretend that I'm okay a lot of the time. And it's actually going to be published tomorrow. So I know that tomorrow will be a different time when this is broadcast.
Tomorrow will be like a month ago. But so listeners.
A month ago. I mean, I don't think it's going to disappear, which I hope not anyway. Yeah. So it should still be there. I thought on the Lucy Writers platform. And I think there's 4 or 5 of us who have put together a short section on it. And it was really interesting because it made me realise it's not only how it affects how I write, but also what I write in terms of the themes and the subject matter. And just took me a chance to reflect on, you know, would I be writing different things or in a different way, you know, if I didn't have this this disability. Anyway, it might be interesting to
that sounds absolutely fascinating. Definitely send me the link and I'll put it
I will send you the link, yeah,
the description of this podcast episode. So talk to me about that. Discuss how do you think your disability affects your form, your process, your method of writing, subject matter?
I think it affects all of it, really. So I think it affects the how, you know, the physical aspect, because sometimes, you know, the brain fog is so bad that I can't actually look at a laptop or a page for more than a few minutes.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's quite hard for people to understand, you know, unless they've experienced that level of brain fog, because everyone gets tired and kind of gets what might feel like brain fog. But I think when your eye muscles are so fatigued that you can't focus, you know, and
ME is very different from just being tired. And I think sometimes people confuse the two, but it's a very specific kind of fatigue, exhaustion.
Yeah, I mean, it affects literally every single function in your body.
Yeah.
And it's not so much fatigue. It's just that it's kind of, you know, it's dysfunctional, you know, it can't function. So sometimes I you know, my muscles in my hands or arms are too painful that I can't hold them up long enough to write on a keyboard. Now that's perhaps one extreme, but I guess because it's very easy to get to that by overdoing something, and overdoing it might not be very much. I'd love to be able to just sort of, you know, have a period where I could just write all night, or kind of have take some day time off work and just think, right, I really want to kind of get some stuff done. And I can't work like that. I can't manage that, unfortunately, because I've only got short periods of time in terms of sort of energy.
So I experience probably at least 1 or 2 days a week where I can't use my arms or my hands enough to type. Sometimes not even, you know, not even to like hold a book or hold my phone. I just have to lie there for 2 days and kind of potato, really. There's no other word for it. Do you find voiced text software helps you?
Well, it's funny, I use it quite a lot with work, and I do quite a lot of writing in my work currently, which perhaps doesn't also help. But I don't tend to use it for kind of creative writing. It's weird that.
Oh wow, that's really interesting.
I hadn't thought about it before. I mean, I have sort of left sort of voice notes and things like that, and that's usually in the middle of the night or if I'm out for a walk or whatever, and I kind of think of something, and it's actually much easier to sort of, you know, speak it into my voice note on the phone rather than attempt to write it. I do use my phone a lot partly because I don't sleep very well with you know, insomnia due to muscle pain. So I do end up doing lots more short snatches of stuff kind of often when I'm awake in the middle of the night. And I think that's what's affected the form. So I, as I said a while ago, I don't really see myself as a poet, but I've ended up writing a lot more poetry and perhaps more experimental form, because I've got these very short sort of snatches of time in which to do stuff. And I think that sort of, whereas I would love to be sitting down and intensively writing a novel, and I've got several that I have started, you know, over the last 20 years or whatever.
Yeah.
But I can't do it when the fatigue is so bad, you know. Yeah. So I feel like I have to be creating and doing something. I mean, the drive is there and the ideas are there. So I end up just doing, you know, bits and pieces and whatever I can. I've ended up also doing kind of more visual poetry and stuff like that, which I've never attempted before.
Yeah.
And I think that's also just for needing to find an outlet for a creative idea and doing it in what, you know, doing it on Canva on my phone at 3 o'clock in the morning, because it's the only any time or energy moment that you've got, you know.
I completely understand this. So, you know, when I'm having really bad cognitive dysfunction or physical issues, short stories and poetry, I did not go to university. I'm not a learned poet. My style doesn't fit into any form in particular, you know, so it's quite a free-flowing process, but I find it so much easier to be able to do, because as you say, the creative drive is there, but not necessarily the ability to be able to sit down and kind of write for hours at a time. So it is very much kind of snatched 10, 20 minutes here or there. And I quite love that our weird disabled bodies are informing our poetic practice or our artistic practice. In fact, I'm going to say this, I want to see an anthology of disability influenced like writing.
Yeah, no, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? And it should exist. I mean, I would hope it.
I'm sure
it has to exist. Maybe we should start that, because I think, you know, and then this was some of the things that other people were writing about in this piece that we did about ME and creative writing, is I think it also, you have a different view of the world. You know, and it's a little bit like you have a different view of the world when you kind of grow up queer and those are, you know, everyone else around you is straight, because you just see the world differently and it can take a while to find your way to fit in. Mm. And it's absolutely the case, if not more so, perhaps when you have a disability of some kind. And I think that different perspective is where it translates so brilliantly into kind of creative work of any kind, because, you know, it might be a bit more surreal, or it might be kind of, you know, just looking at things in an interesting way that sort of resonates with other people. I mean, if I can say, I think what's great about your work is it's so powerfully expressed, you know, and I can understand that perhaps a lot of it comes from speaking it out loud first rather than being a poet on the page, you know, first, as it were, because, well, you know, you really have that, bring that drive and that passion and the sort of, you know, you take the listener, and I've mainly heard you as a listener, you know, rather than reading it, on a sort of bit of an emotional roller coaster quite often, in your work. But
thank you.
I should say, you didn't mention it. You were being very kind of humble at the beginning, but George was an absolutely stunning guest at our Genderfucks launch in London, and not only read your work, but also was a wonderful host and MC for us. So
thank you again
for that.
No, it was my absolute pleasure. As I said, you know, it's quite hard, and as I'm sure you appreciate, being disabled, but then also having to put on a face to the world, then also having to read while coping with, you know, brain fog from ME, but then also at the same time as being emotionally overwhelmed because you're listening to people's poetry, which is absolutely fantastic, and you're like, oh my god, I'm just crying because, you know, you've read a poem about your mum not really being accepting of you being gay, and I was like, oh god, I'm dead. and then having to go back and be like, yeah, I'm the hostess, host with the most. And yeah, it was a very weird, wonderful situation to be.
Yeah, well, you were fantastic, you know.
Oh, thank you. Absolute honour. How do you think art and creativity can help people to better understand invisible disabilities?
Oh, gosh.
And I'm going to say, you've put in your answer, I don't know the answer to this. Interesting topic. So listeners, you're going to listen to two people who don't know what they're talking about, just kind of shoot the breeze.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad I was honest with you back then in terms of not knowing the answer. I think it's a really interesting question.
Anything in terms of better representation that encompasses a wider variety of disabilities is going to be good. And I think dynamic disabilities, you're talking about how one day you can kind of be okay, you're technically fit enough to work, you're technically not eligible for benefits, and yet you can crash out for weeks or months at a time. People need to have a better understanding of that, because that's going to have a direct impact on the benefit system, on how disabled people are treated in society, on what policies are made. And I've completely gone off on a tangent there, but I think art and creativity really can help people change their understanding.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree, because I think ultimately, you know, this is where art has a sort of, dare I say, a sort of political drive, but political with a small p, you know, in terms of raising people's awareness and helping to kind of drive about change. And I think the great thing about art is it often happens, and I mean art in its widest sense, obviously, often happens outside of kind of sort of normal community or societal structures. You know, I mean, it's great when it kind of happens, you know, in the academies and all that kind of stuff. But I think what we've seen a lot of, and I think it's you know, again, the move to online, and now that we have this sort of you know, in some ways the internet has for many people, obviously not in every country, but it has sort of level the playing field a little bit in terms of people being able to get their work out there, you know, whether it's music or it's about writing or it's about artwork, and just being able to share it with people. Whereas previously, you know, you had to find a gallery that would, you know, show your work, or you had to get a record contract, or, you know, or you
somebody had to
get a formal publishing contract.
Yeah.
You know, it feels as though there are alternative ways to sharing creative work. It does mean often that they don't pay, and that obviously the downside of that is that it kind of, there's perhaps an expectation by the public to be able to get all these things for free, and that it's great that people are creating so much, but, you know, I think the perceived value of that work can perhaps sort of go down as a result, which is a separate problem and maybe another separate topic. But I think where you've got a proliferation of so many different voices expressing thoughts and feelings and experiences in the artwork that they do, it does help just to make that more visible. Whether it's, you know, whether it's about someone's precarious financial situation, or refugee status, or sexuality, or disability, or discrimination against them because of the color of their skin. I mean, regardless of what it is, there's a way to sort of express that quite directly, I think, in an art form that might, where those channels for communicating that might not be open to them otherwise, you know, in society. Yeah. So I think the art, what was the question? You know, art and I suppose how it can support sort of making these things less hidden. Was that kind of the question?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, I think it can, because it can be quite immediate, and certainly now it's a little bit easier to be able to kind of just share work. You know, even if you're doing it on TikTok, you can get, you know, hundreds of thousands of people viewing whatever message you want to get across, and that's something that simply wasn't available to people kind of pre-internet, I guess.
Yeah. And that's something I find fascinating, because a lot of people aren't going to sit down if they're not interested in, say, refugees or disability or queer issues, for instance. They're not going to sit down and read a whole pamphlet or a book or an essay, but they might sit there scrolling on their phone, looking at TikTok, looking at an Instagram reel, or looking at, you know, even just a few tweets or something. And so I think the way that we influence people has changed. And I think it still comes under that broad umbrella of art. And I think it's art and representation that then influence people. Because at the end of the day, the way we interpret the world, it's all about stories. And I think however you can get those stories across, whether it be poetry, art, tweets, TikTok, whatever, then you can start to get people on side. and you can start to see a bit more inclusion. And it's the same for the queer community, for any marginalised community, you've just got to get people to understand and get them on side.
Mm, yeah, no, I completely agree. And I was just thinking about what I said about the internet, and I didn't want to sort of make it sound as though, you know, these things didn't happen before, or that the internet is somehow saving us all, because obviously it has its sort of, you know, kind of disadvantages as well, and it's dark places. But people were doing these things before, you know, they were printing zines, you know, and kind of handing them out on the street, or they were busking, you know, to share their music and maybe the message that was behind it, or they were painting graffiti murals to share their art, and obviously that often had a message behind it as well. So these things have always existed. It's just that perhaps now with technology, you know, that it's easy, it's quicker to share it, and you know, you can reach a wider audience. But I think that kind of, there's always been perhaps, I think, also an underground aspect to people who are marginalized in some way, you know, whether it's sexuality or disability or race or whatever. And I kind of don't, I kind of quite like that underground aspect of it, you know, because you think, well, we're special and different. In some ways, I like to be special and different. I don't want to be part of the herd. But at the same time, you know, you want to feel represented and you want your voice to be heard. You know, I don't consciously write stuff in order to do that, I don't think, but it has, at least for me, been a powerful way to feel that I now have a voice to talk about stuff, you know, that might be a bit difficult or people perhaps haven't wanted to listen to. And that, certainly from a personal point of view, has been very empowering.
Yeah, and you said that you felt that there might be some collective trauma for those from an older generation who didn't feel like they had a voice, or that, you know, these were topics that you couldn't write about, or other people might not be interested in reading. But nowadays we've got a far better awareness and acceptance of this and you know, other issues such as disability, queerness, race, gender, everything. And yeah, we have got more specific opportunities for marginalised writers. What's your view on that?
In terms of opportunities?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, sorry, this is not answering the question, but as you were saying, and I was listening, honestly, it's just that my brain was sort of going off in different tangents, because I had this idea about collective trauma. And I think in addition to perhaps those that have kind of lived through Section 28 and lived through periods when, you know, it was very difficult to be out. And that's just in this country, obviously, you know, it's still the case in many parts of the world. You know, I think there's also a kind of collective trauma, I'm guessing, through people, and I'm talking specifically about ME, and obviously, you know, not to suggest that it's not difficult for people with all sorts of other disabilities. Mm. Of course it is. But I think because it was an illness that was so little understood and so much maligned, I think people who perhaps were diagnosed with it, you know, relative, you know, in the 90s, when that was the case, or before, of course, you know, where it was just assumed to be this kind of yuppie flu thing, and who've perhaps been pushed into GET programs and you know, CBT and all this sort of stuff that hasn't helped, and has for a lot of people made it worse. I wonder if there's also a kind of collective trauma in terms of having been so so let down by the you know, the medical practice as well as if you like the media and community at large. And I just, and this is where my brain was going, and I wonder also whether it's a little bit similar to perhaps what people who've got long COVID might be going through, and particularly those who might have contracted COVID pre-vaccination, you know, a year or so ago, and who are now really kind of suffering those sort of long-term impacts. Which only now, you know, only in the last sort of few months, really, it feels the medical profession are sort of starting to take seriously and understand how it might be affecting the body. And I think certainly, again, from the sort of, I hesitate to say ME community, because I don't really feel that I'm in it necessarily, but know enough about it, but that that there's almost a sense of hope now in terms of thinking, oh gosh, that we can see these people going through something quite similar to what we've all gone through. And aside from the huge sort of painful empathy, if you like, of seeing how much people are suffering, there's a real sense of kind of, oh gosh, maybe, you know, they can find the answer. And it's something that might help us too.
So sorry,
not answering your question at all, but it was just this idea of collective trauma.
No, oh my God. Do you know what? Abandon my question, because that I think is such an interesting topic to what, but yeah, it's awful and it's interesting to look at, because I know that I, you know, in the online community for those with ME and with long COVID, I'm seeing this massive outpouring of offers of help and support from the ME community reaching out to those with long COVID, because people with long COVID have been panicking, because it is very similar to ME, you know, in that people have been largely abandoned by the medical professionals because they don't know enough, because the research isn't there. We've been abandoned by the government, who aren't putting any COVID precautions in place. And so there's just going to be growing numbers of those with long COVID. And I think that collective rage and that trauma is just going to continue to build. And I don't really know what happens, but there is definitely that sense of hope amongst the ME community that now it's become so large, we are going to at some point reach the point of critical mass, and we're going to see a change, some kind of research and help.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. And you know, I think obviously it's important to look at what's happening in a way separately within medical research and the medical community, with whatever the policies the government is putting in place. You know, I mean, unfortunately, one is very much impacted by the other, but you know, it does seem as though that the sort of, you know, there is funding and there is money going into it, you know, not much in the UK, but certainly in the US. You know, but we are in the process of starting this big decode project specifically on ME, which has been in the planning for the last couple of years, which is sort of really understanding genetically what kind of what's happening to people, and looking at biomarkers and things like that. But so, you know, might get there eventually, but and I wonder whether that makes it a little bit easier to sort of come out, you know, going back to your first question, you know, about kind of coming out about having been queer and coming out about having ME, you know, it is something perhaps that I'm also starting to feel a little bit more, I'm not sure if empowered is the right word, but I'm, you know, maybe it's also because I'm nearing 50 now, you know, so it's a sense of like, for goodness sake, you know, as I go into my senility years, whether I'm just a bit like, look, fuck it, I'm too old for this shit anymore. I'm just
exactly. There's got to be an element of that. I mean, you know, it would be nice if we all reached that stage earlier in life and stopped giving a fuck, but it's become a part of popular culture and it's been embraced by society a lot more than disability has. And so I think it is, in so many ways, depending on your circumstances and who you're around and where you work and, you know, everything, it is in a lot of ways easier for many of us to come out as queer than as disabled.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that respect, with the exception of our trans siblings who, you know, of course, are just suffering so much at the moment. And you know, it obviously, aside from supporting them and it being, I think, even more important that we hear their voices and their stories, you know, as you said, it is about stories, because unfortunately, you know, with the way that the media operates in this country, you know, things kind of get always brought down to the sort of lowest common denominator an extreme kind of representation, and you know, and then social media, etc., doesn't really allow for sort of nuanced discussion about things. So we end up with kind of certainly seeing a lot more kind of hate speech and this, which is terrifying. And obviously in the US, it's even worse. So I think there is a sort of sense that, OK, well, are we taking an aggressive step? You know, I mean, it was starting with I'm doing inverted commas, like the trans debate. I mean, there isn't a debate, you know, this is.
Yeah, exactly.
These are people, you know, we're all just people. And there's a worry that might also be the case, that with losing losing kind of queer rights, you know, but
we're recording,
we have to fight for them, you know.
We're recording this podcast in a time which is so inherently unstable. We've got politicians who are running to be prime minister who are fundamentally against trans rights, who are against abortion. We could really be seeing quite a big backslide here, and it is a terrifying time to kind of look around. And you know, reading the newspaper today was Horrific. I can't believe, sorry, I'm sat here somewhat stunned that we've got a cost of living crisis, we've got a climate crisis, we've got so many things going. We're in the midst of a pandemic still, which a lot of people seem to have forgotten. And politicians are naming their policies that they want to hang their hat on, the hill that they want to die on, is to do with transgender people. And I'm like, why? Why? How is this relevant to you? How is this the hot topic when there's so many other legitimate things that need sorting out and trans people just want to live their lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely depressing, isn't it? I mean, it's just such a race to the bottom at the moment with you know, the current government and the leadership kind of fight. And it's just really sad because obviously they're doing that because they see that as a way to win votes, which is you know, the most worrying thing, that kind of choosing those sort of topics and sort of escalating them to a topic when, you know, there isn't a debate. You know, transgender people exist, just, and they just want to get on and live their lives. You know, let's just support them to do that. Kind of creating an issue out of something that should no longer be an issue. It's deeply worrying. I mean, I think you're right in that we have a lot more freedom. You know, certainly as a queer person, I feel like I have a lot more freedom and rights than I used to, or perhaps obviously the previous generation had, and I'm grateful to that generation for fighting, and kind of feel it's important to sort of keep waving the flag, as it were, because I don't think we can always take those rights for granted.
No, absolutely not. And I, if in any way what I said previously, and I think it did sound like I was saying, oh, it's like super easy to come out as queer compared to being disabled, absolutely take that back. And I didn't mean that. I think what...
Well, no, I think you're right. I wasn't disagreeing with you. I think you're right. It's just, I think it is so much easier. And I think we're very fortunate in that respect. But maybe it's just me being a bit of a pessimist. I just worry maybe we can't take it so much for granted, unfortunately.
I think to my own people in my own personal experience, like coming out as pansexual, they were angry, but they got over it, you know, within a matter of months, I think, which was okay. But then when I came out as non-binary, it got a little bit messier and a little bit nastier, and a little bit more final in terms of the arguments that we had and the people that I've lost. And so, yeah, I think if you're the right side of queer, it is probably easier. But yeah, trans people, it's just horrendous.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a little bit like, you know, we accept you as queer if it fits into what our idea of what that is.
Yeah, that's a much more eloquent way of, thank you.
That's fine, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's like it's fine to have sort of drag queens on primetime TV.
Yeah,
but we're not okay with trans women. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well,
yeah, exactly.
I'm not suggesting that they're the same thing, but it's that kind of sense of a certain level of queerness is okay, because it's all shiny, happy kind of people waving rainbow flags, but kind of real people living their lives and perhaps being, you know, not conforming to what society has decided is the norm, inverted commas. There has always been, you know, such a massive, wonderful fluidity of sexuality and gender, you know, but suddenly now we're getting preoccupied with that, you know, in 2022. And as you say, we've really got more important things to be focusing our attention on. Exactly. It's very strange.
It's so strange. I just remember, so I performed a poem at Pride, and like one of the lines that it was talking about kind of like the capitalistic money-making side of the queer community, not as in the queer community, but how corporations kind of use the queer culture to make a rainbow dollar. Don't the straights love this particular rendition of queer? And it is very much, you're right, they love the drag queens, they love a very particular kind of queer because it's marketable and it's because what people will accept, but otherwise we're very much sidelined.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think that's always been the case, particularly if you're anything other than a gay man. And that's not to suggest that gay men have it easy. I mean, they have their own challenges. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I use the label queer because for me, I'm not suggesting it's the same for everybody. For me, the label queer suggests a kind of cultural identity more than a sexual one, but that's just my kind of use of the
term.
What
were the bell hooks kind of definition of the term?
Yeah. I mean, I'm also a lesbian, and I would be comfortable describing myself as a woman. It's just that for me, that what that means is fairly meaningless in terms of what other people might mean for that definition, if you see what I mean. For me, that's sort of defined more in terms of the fact that I prefer to sleep with other women, if you see what I mean, rather than it defines how I look or how I behave or how I dress or what I think or anything else. I think it's that often the problem of this terminology. So I choose to use the pronouns she, they, because I feel that most accurately conveys where I sit on that continuum, if you see what I mean. I think it's much harder to do that if you are female identifying in some shape or form than if you are a kind of male identifying, if that makes sense. I'm sorry if I'm using the wrong terminology, but I think it's also difficult, perhaps, coming out as a lesbian in the 90s, where it was also expected that you're either butch or femme, and there's only those two categories, and you have to just choose, you're one or the other.
Yeah.
And it almost seems a little bit similar to the kind of false dichotomies and the false kind of debates that people are having now in terms of, where you sit, what your pronouns are, where you sort of sit on the gender spectrum. It's society's way of trying to put people into boxes when people aren't box-shaped,
Absolutely. And I know for me, like my disability has this weird influence on my identity, kind of beyond the scope of, I'm disabled. But I think kind of everyone tries to define their place in society, or at least feel comfortable with it. And I think for myself personally, as a pansexual, non-binary, disabled person, I often just kind of feel like the line is, I feel like a mythical creature, but actually I sometimes just feel completely disconnected from my form as well. And it, like, nothing really seems particularly relevant in terms of my gender, someone else's gender, whatever. It just all kind of, I just feel a bit like a floating blob, which is quite nice in some ways.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean in terms of that sort of disassociation that you can have a lot often
at the ME,
from your body. Yeah. But it's one of the reasons why I JP Seabright is a pen name. And I chose a pen name that was deliberately kind of gender neutral, if you like, or not sort of specifically identifying one gender or another, because I just felt it's just not relevant to who I feel I am. So I suppose I describe myself as, I'm not sure if gender I'm ambivalent is the right word, but in terms of, it's just not important to me. It doesn't feel like it identifies who I am in any way. It only becomes important when somebody, and I need to tick a box. Yeah. If you see what I mean.
I consider myself a gender mutineer.
yeah, which is wonderful, idea. But particularly when I write, and what I write about, I want to feel free to write about whatever weird shit is in my brain. I don't want to feel as though people are going to read it a particular way based on what they think my gender is. And I don't specifically myself feel that I'm non-binary, because a lot of people perceive that to be a third gender. And for some people, it might be. The point is that we're using words and we're then trying to kind of lock down their meaning, yeah, if you see what I mean, and getting hung up on how we define this particular thing, when people aren't that rigid in terms of who they are. And and it kind of varies from day to day, in terms of whether I might feel more quote male or quote female in terms of how I behave or how I think or what I do.
Yeah.
I don't want to feel tied down to having to make a decision about that, or having to prove that to anybody else. It's no one else's business,
And so when it comes to your writing, because I know you mentioned you chose a deliberately ambiguous name. Does it have an impact on how you write?
I think only in that I feel more free to write about whatever I might want to write about. I've only very recently sort of started sharing a photo of myself, because I kind of wanted to you know, in some ways I kind of wanted to kind of be this, you know, completely mythical creature, if you like.
Yes.
You know,
in terms
of it doesn't, you know, my gender and who I, what I look like and anything else, it's not important, you know. I mean, it's not because I have this lofty ideal of like the writing should speak for itself, you know, but just because, you know, in a way that persona, if you like, of what I write about and who I am as a writer, if that doesn't sound too pretentious, is one thing, and who I might be in my other life, you know, my non-writing life, is something else. And I they're probably merging more and more, but certainly at the beginning I felt quite comfortable to keep them separate, and I quite liked that they were kind of separate. And I guess it gave me a freedom to write about stuff that I probably wouldn't do if I was writing under my birth name.
Yeah. And how does that, so you've obviously in Genderfucks, you've got some quite personal experiences written in your poems. So how does it work alongside those?
Yeah, well, because, only because I don't tell anyone that I write.
Right, fantastic. That's a good way of doing it, I suppose.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I do touch on quite a lot of themes, which are, of course, real experiences. I guess I only feel free to do that because I don't use my real name, and I've never told my family that I write, you know. So friends know, but only recently. So actually at the Genderfucks launch was the first time that I kind of told some of my and some of my oldest friends, you know, university friends, that I write. So which is why it's so fantastic that some of them came along, because it's just something that I feel incredibly you know, I just lack a lot of confidence in it, to be honest, and feel a bit, not embarrassed, but a bit self-conscious, I suppose, about putting, particularly when it's something where I put so much of myself onto the page, as it were.
Yeah, I can understand the feeling of being exposed. I think in terms of like your poetry, it's excellent though. And you know, that I can't believe that you're, sorry, I'm always amazed by the people that kind of have this sense of doubt about themselves and their writing when, you know, everyone else is like, my God, they're fantastic, they're incredible. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess we all have that sort of, well, maybe we don't all, but certainly that imposter syndrome thing. And, you know, I, you know, as I said, I'm pushing 50, and I guess there's a sense of really wanting to make up for lost time, because I've always wanted to write, you know, and I started writing, you know, when I was at university, and then stopped. For decades, you know, partly, well, for all sorts of reasons, trauma kind of comes into it, and kind of dealing with that, plus dealing with ME, and just trying to kind of function on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
But also just, you know, not having any confidence that anything I had to write or say was any good, you know.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you one final question, and then I hope I'm going to ask you one final question. So in terms of your ME and your diagnosis and the fact that you got a diagnosis at a time when it wasn't particularly well understood, and as a result of that, you know, you've got the medical professionals that are pushing you to do things which aren't necessarily good for your body, but because you don't know any better, because there aren't any alternatives, we do often tend to override our bodies kind of warning signals, and we do push ourselves too far, and we do normally end up injuring ourselves. Does that then have an impact, or for you, did that have an impact on your ability to trust yourself and your self-confidence, and then possibly, you know, also in terms of your writing?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm quite good now at knowing, you know, when I'm overdoing it. And that's just through trial and error and of having had this thing for such a bloody long time, in that I, you know, but you do end up making choices, thinking, okay, I have to do this thing, or I want to do this thing, whether it's kind of going to help to meet someone for lunch, or, you know, needing to visit someone at the weekend, or whatever it might be, where you know that it's going to be too much and you know you're going to crash.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, most of the time now it's sort of crashing for a few days or 5 days, you know, it might be a week, but rather than months. But you kind of do it anyway, either because you have to or because you want to, because you just want to be able to have some sort of a life.
Yeah.
So I think Most of the time, although, as I said, it wasn't predictable, I guess just through having lived through it and learnt just from my own experience of what I can and can't do and when I might crash and what's too much and this sort of thing, but also just by stopping myself from doing so many things that I would normally want to do, but I just can't. I think I've in a way I sort of trust those warning signs, if you see what I mean. So I don't know whether that impacts on my writing, other than what I do notice again is where there is sort of, you know, you mentioned, you know, in some ways the emotion of kind of reading stuff out loud, or hearing it read out loud. And I think particularly if you're touching on themes that might be obviously quite personal to you that you're reading, or you're hearing someone else read and it kind of really resonates, and it's that kind of sharp intake of breath when something that they say kind of gets you. And I notice how much that affects me physically, you know, completely bodily, you know, and when I'm quite fatigued, you know, it affects me so much more than it might otherwise.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you said that, you know, something might bring tears to your eyes, you know, either because something you're writing or something that you're reading or hearing. And when my fatigue is quite bad, when the ME is quite bad, then that could have an impact that could last for hours or even, you know, into the next day, just that either the adrenaline or the emotion. And I guess that's one of the weird kind of impacts of your body being so fatigued that every small little kind of thing that requires energy can have quite a big impact, sometimes in ways that you don't expect. I didn't answer your question again, did I?
No, it's fine. Do you know what? I'm going to, this has been the best interview, just asking questions, and then I get a completely random answer, but it's...
It's like spinning roulette, isn't it? I'll ask a question and see what answer comes out.
It's fantastic. Just this is the way it should
be. I think I wasn't sure how to answer your question, so no, I just sorry,
it was probably a rambly kind of sideways question, so that's probably fine.
But you can edit this all out later anyway, can't you? Make it sound really slick.
Yeah, it is wild that, like, you know, as you say, you can read something traumatic or even joyful and it's got physical consequences that can last for days. It's, yeah, the joys of ME.
yeah. I mean, I'll give you a real life example if I can kind of get a little bit kind of on the nose, as it were. So I was asked last week to be part of a poetry reading fundraiser for Planned Parenthood, you know, in response to the overturning of Roe versus Wade, that was run by Richard Capener of Hem Press. Mm-hmm. And sorry, it won't be last week for people listening, but it was
that outrage.
First week of July. And I think there was five of us reading, and, you know, I was really honoured to be asked to do this, and we were trying to raise money, and I think we raised £200-300 or something like that in the end.
Excellent, well done.
You know, and it was quite an emotional evening, you know, in terms of the topics that people were choosing to you know, share, and I was sort of sharing something that I'd written the night of hearing about this, and kind of obviously on social media kind of seeing a lot of people's traumatic experiences of abortion or not being able to get it, or kind of circumstances around it, or, you know, just, you know, the kind of the need for people to make decisions about their own bodies. And obviously this is key to transgender people as well. It's like, you know, this is your body, it's your choice, you know, let's not let the state or anyone else get involved in those decisions. And I was reading something about being raped, and it wasn't something that I'd ever shared in quite that way, quite so directly, to you know, to actual other people, you know, in a room, even though it was on Zoom. As you'll know, that, you know, there's some references to that in some of my poems in Genderfucks. And it was kind of a bit nerve-wracking to do that, but I kind of really wanted to do that. And that's another thing that I found really empowering about being able to write, and perhaps also, again, one of the reasons why I choose a pen name. But I was shaking so much from it, you know, for hours afterwards. And I kind of knew that that might happen. So it was sort of expected, and I could kind of manage it. But yeah, I think going back a little bit to your reference to trauma, that you know, and for me, I think that's sort of very much bound up with my ME as well, in terms of kind of just managing that long-term trauma and how it sort of is impacted by, but also impacts on the kind of symptoms that I might be having at any time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really interesting correlation. I definitely find writing helps.
Yeah.
No, but it is really interesting. And I said I find writing really helps. Then I was thinking, do I though? Because every time I submit, I'm currently submitting a poetry chapbook. And I've got a few poems about being raped as well. And right. And every time I scroll past those poems, I feel somewhat traumatized. Which is quite funny, because it's something that I wrote, and obviously the act of writing it was really therapeutic and it was fantastic. But now I trigger myself with my own work, which is counterproductive.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and probably in a whole other conversation. And again, apologies for kind of dropping that in without any warning. I shouldn't have done that. But I think it's not so dissimilar to what you were saying at the beginning, in terms of feeling able to kind of come out about sexuality or about disability,
yeah,
or about kind of trauma of this kind, you know. And unfortunately, sexual violence, you know, whoever the perpetrator is and the victim and whatever it is something that still is incredibly difficult for people to talk about, because it's like, oh, let's not go there, it's a bit unpleasant. And the fact that it's so difficult to kind of come out about it, because obviously, you know, you might not want to talk about it, but the, you know, to close friends or family, it might be necessary or helpful. It is something that can potentially be a lifelong trauma, and has a physical impact as well as just sort of mentally kind of dealing with the after effects of that. Certainly, you know, I personally feel it's had a big part to play in my sort of triggers, if you like, for ME.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast episode where we were talking about the correlation between trauma and kind of physical illness or health conditions. And we're not saying that, you know, trauma has caused a psychological issue, which means that you think that you're unwell. It literally affects your nervous system, which affects kind of every function in your body. And so obviously there's going to be some kind of impact there. And I know for me, like my PTSD because of sexual trauma, it affects everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the very least, it affects the immune system.
Yeah. So,
I mean, if it was only that, then that again might be a trigger, or at least a contributing factor to an illness like ME, you know, where I know, again, for myself, and it won't be the same for everybody, I absolutely don't want to suggest that, but you know, as also having kind of Epstein-Barr virus, and that, you know, having that kind of
you're so fancy.
Oh yeah, I know. You know, having that sort of kind of viral infection, again, at university, you know, at the same time that, you know, these sorts of traumas occurred, and not having support and stuff. And again, I'm not suggesting that that's the reason that I got ME, but you know, it's this massive kind of overload on the body, that, you know, the body's just not built to kind of cope with those sorts of things. Can unfortunately have a very long-term effect in so many ways that are beyond, if you like, PTSD and kind of psychologically dealing with the after effects of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm 100% in agreement.
The reality is that, you know, and I don't know if this is the case for you, is that you end up speculating about what might have caused it, mainly for yourself.
Yeah. Have you got something that you would like to share with our listeners, either your work or somebody else's?
I mean, it depends on your time. I mean, I could read, if people want, the short piece that I wrote about this ME creative writing that's going to be published a month ago, if, if, if you want. It's not very long, but because it so directly relates to what we've been talking about.
Oh my God, absolutely. Anything you want to share is fantastic.
I could do that quite quickly now.
You're trying to get it up on your screen.
I am trying to get it up on my screen, exactly. and it feels right given that we only had the proof for it just before we started speaking.
Perfect.
That might give me time to work out what mythical creature I might be.
There you go. You're playing for time.
I am. Yeah.
But no, with all of this, I absolutely love that, you know, the more we talk about stuff, the less taboo it becomes, and the more people could just really get on with.
Sorry, that was me knocking my microphone over.
Oh, nice. Oh, well done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I guess I, these are things that I've not spoken about for years. And, you know, some of the things we've talked about, you know, I haven't told many people. So it's actually kind of given me the confidence and the freedom, if you like, to kind of just think, okay, this is the things that make up who I am. And I don't want to hide that anymore, whether it's sexuality or disability or trauma. You know,
I think it's really important, because when I look back to dealing with, you know, dealing with disability, dealing with trauma, dealing with, you know, coming out as bi, then pan, then non-binary, every single one of those has the thing itself has not been the issue, really. It's been how people have reacted to it, or it's been a feeling of shame that I have to hide something or not talk about it. But it's very rarely been that the thing itself and dealing with the thing itself has been the issue.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Shall I read this thing?
Yes, please.
Okay. So this is a short bit of prose that's kind of nonfiction, obviously. It's not a poem. But it was the remit was to sort of write about how ME kind of affects our creativity, you know, in both respects. No. The uncertainty and precarity of this chronic disability, the inability to plan and have control over your life, encourages becoming other, existing outside normal society, and its expectations on our bodies and minds. It requires living vicariously within and through fantasy, even if that fantasy is when you might be strong enough to get out of bed and leave the house, or cook a meal, or eat out at a restaurant, or visit your family. With ME, nothing can be taken for granted, and these daily tales of the unexpected are both the story in which we inhabit ourselves and the way in which we create. ME affects what I write, when I write, and how I write. I'm often awake in the middle of the night, unable to sleep due to muscle pain, headaches, palpitations, and other discomfort. These twitching hours are when my mind is often at its most lucid. The irony of being spared a few hours of the persistent drizzling rain of brain fog that I have throughout the day. I write in short snatches, moments when the fog lifts for a while. My lifelong held ambition to write a novel has been most severely impacted by this. It simply requires too much concentration, too much effort. Even on fog-free days, my eye muscles struggle to focus on a laptop screen, and my arms ache too much to hold my hands to a keypad for very long. The same with pen and paper. As my health has worsened again over the last 2 years, to the extent that paid employment is a huge challenge, I've turned to poetry and more experimental work. It was not a conscious decision, but as the snatches of time for creative thought and play became smaller and less certain, I found these new forms of creative expression as a way to fulfill that need. And it is a need. People with chronic disabilities have as much desire and potential to have wild and creative lives as anyone else. For myself, I find that it gives energy rather than takes it away, although it may just prove to be cost neutral. But it undoubtedly refreshes the parts of my brain that other activities, those that I can still do, cannot reach. The subject matter of my writing has always reflected my personal interests, i.e. somewhat misanthropic tendencies, dark matter, post-apocalyptic lullabies, speculative fiction, surrealistic pillows of visual poetry or abstract art. And it's impossible to judge whether that might be different if I didn't have ME. It's been a part of my life for more than half of it. I can only remember ever being other. Whether this gives me an insight into different experiences or forms or ways of seeing, I don't know. But I do know that writing is the only thing that provides some sort of relief. On the page, I can be anyone I want to be. On the page, there are no constraints.
Wow, JP, that was absolutely fantastic. What a wonderful window into being a writer with ME.
Well, thank you. I mean, it these sorts of disabilities affect us all differently, but that's certainly my experience. And I think I'll send you the link because I think it might be of interest to your listeners.
Oh, please send me the link.
And just actually, to be honest, really, really heartening that it was, as a topic, it was sufficient interest to a sort of online platform such as Lucy Writers to want to kind of, you know, publish that and to kind of want to you know, give space and visibility to this topic. So
it's so important to get more voices like that heard. And that piece in particular, I think when people ask me what it's like to have ME and to try and function, to try and write, I'm definitely going to point them in that direction because that really sums it up for me personally anyway. Other people obviously might feel differently, but it's just fantastic. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Now, JP Seabright, very quickly, if you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
I'm sorry, I completely forgot about this very important point. I think I'd like to be some kind of dragon. A dragon's myth, you know,
yes,
enough.
JP, you're talking to George the Dragon.
Yeah, well, yes, of course. Sorry, I didn't mean to kind of pick that because that's your thing. Because I like dragons. I like them because they are all very different and individual. Yeah. And I think you kind of be, you know, a sort of scary dragon, or you could be a kind of, you know, with my toddler, we're reading quite a lot of books that have dragons in. And they're generally quite kind of fun, sociable creatures.
Mm.
So, I mean, I'm quite introspective. I quite like to have my quiet time, and I sort of need that to sort of recoup energy. So I quite like the idea of sort of hiding away in a cave and just reading some books.
Flying around a mountain.
Nice walks in the forest, you know, and maybe scaring people if they kind of get too close and I don't like them.
Yeah, but having regular barbecues, you know.
Yeah, you know,
being a dragon,
having a nice sort of, you know, dip in a nearby lake. flying would be pretty cool. I'd quite like that. Yeah.
See, I'm biased, but I do think dragon is a very good shout.
yeah. I mean, perhaps not that inventive a choice, but I like
it's a fantastic
dragon. Yeah, I would be a purple dragon.
Oh, okay. Oh, there you go. That's automatically, that's very inventive and imaginative.
Yeah, I don't know. I think just purple is a good colour for dragons, at least.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for asking me. I mean, really a joy and an honour to be invited. So I really appreciate that. And fantastic to talk to you about all sorts of stuff. Hopefully some of it makes sense. But I really appreciate you giving, you know, what you do, I suppose, in this podcast, you know, giving people a platform and a voice. I think it's really important.
Until next time, stay curious.